Shalom out of Arnix. Welcome to our next session in the Book of Isaiah. We are in session number 16 today. We're going through Ariel's exegetical outline notes of the Book of Isaiah, produced by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum. All right, let's jump into our review of the previous session. In the previous session, we were in the Second Coming, chapter 11, 11 through 16. We saw that at the Second Coming, Israel would no longer partake of idolatry. Idolatry would be a thing of the past, like these ladies up on the Golan Heights worshiping this little clay figurine. That won't happen again. We also saw in Isaiah 11:14 that the united kingdom, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom, would swoop down on the Philistines to the west. That's the Philistine plain. Now, this is a map of the Philistine plain at its largest extent. The Philistine plain has expanded and contracted according to the strength of the Philistines. And of course, they were destroyed long ago, but all of this territory is not in Jewish hands. The Gaza Strip from Gaza down to the Egyptian border is in Palestinian hands right now. But when the kingdom, this will all become Jewish territory. We also learn that the sons of Ammon will be subject to them. The Ammonites lived here in northern Jordan today. This will come under Jewish sovereignty in the kingdom. And the Jewish people will possess Edom and Moab. Edom and Moab are located down here in the south, with Moab in central Jordan today and Edom in southern Jordan today. So this area and this area will be Jewish territory in the kingdom. We also learned that there would be two miracles associated with the return. The tongue of Egypt, the Sea of Egypt, the Gulf of Suez would be dried up, and the Euphrates River would be broken into small streams. That would allow for verse 16 to come to pass, that there would be a highway from Assyria for the remnant of the Jewish people out of Assyria into the land of Israel. So from the Second Coming, we then moved into the kingdom in chapter 12, verses 1 through 6. We saw that a united Jewish people will experience the second and final worldwide regathering to the land of Israel with songs of joy and praise. That was the key feature of chapter 12. Now, as we moved into chapter 13, we move into a section called the Oracles Against the Nations, and this consists of Isaiah 13 through Isaiah 23. It's a very difficult section to exegete. And so we looked at some principles to prepare us for the going through this difficult section of Isaiah. First of all, we learned that the oracles are arranged thematically, not chronologically. And the thematic development follows this pattern. First of all, we'll talk about Babylon. God will talk about Babylon, which is the chronological end, Babylon of the tribulation. Then we'll jump back to Assyria and talk about the Assyrian destruction, and this is the chronological start of the period. And in between the two, these are the two bookends of the period. Let me get there. These are the two bookends of the period. Babylon at the end, Assyria at the beginning, and then in between the details about how God will be dealing with the nations approach Israel, that intersect with Israel. So this chart kind of sums it up as well. We start with Babylon of the tribulation. That's the end of God's worldwide plan. Then we jump back to Assyria of Isaiah's day. That's the start of God's plan. The conquered nations, the nations conquered by Assyria, Philistia, Moab, Syria, Israel, and Ethiopia are now dealt with. This happens close to Isaiah's day. Then we take a look at Egypt, but this is not Egypt of Isaiah's day. This is Egypt of the tribulation, Egypt of the far future. We come back to Egypt of the Assyrian conquest, and then we talk about Babylon of the Medo-Persian conquest, both of these happening closer to Isaiah's day than the tribulation. So I just put it in the Isaiah's day column, even though they were happening a little after Isaiah. Then we take a look at Edom, but this is Edom of the tribulation period all the way to the end of the program. And finally, we'll finish up with a review of Arabia during the Assyrian devastation, and then Jerusalem and Tyre during the Babylonian conquest. Again, closer to Isaiah's day than the tribulation. That's why they're in the Isaiah's day column. So that's basically the trip we will take through the oracles against the nations. We began with the city of Babylon in chapter 13. And that meant we moved to the tribulation period, chapter 13, verse 1. Now, we also learned about the three primary purposes for the time of Jacob's trouble. The first purpose is to make an end of wickedness and wicked ones, and that's the idea that Isaiah is dealing with in Isaiah 13, verses 9 and verse 11. But there are two more purposes of the tribulation period. Secondly, to bring about a worldwide revival. This is in chapter 7 of Revelation. And thirdly, to break the power or the stubborn will of the holy people in order to bring about Israel's national salvation. And that is covered in Daniel chapter 12. So those are the purposes for the tribulation, the time of Jacob's trouble. We also learn that there are five blackouts associated with the tribulation. The first one, just before the tribulation. The second one during the first quarter of the tribulation, the third blackout associated with the second quarter of the tribulation, the fourth blackout in the second half of the tribulation, and then the final blackout as soon as the tribulation comes to end, at the very end of the tribulation. So five blackouts associated with the tribulation. Now we finished up last session with Isaiah 13:17. Behold, I'm going to stir up the Medes against them who will not value silver or take pleasure in gold. So the Medes are going to lead the attack against the city of Babylon during the tribulation period. And we can map that out on our Campaign of Armageddon map. This phenomena will cover the first three steps of the Campaign of Armageddon. So we begin with step number one. The Antichrist armies will assemble at Armageddon, or Har-Megiddo. Now Har-Megiddo is a little mountain overlooking the plain of Jezreel. So all the nations of the world will send military supplies and personnel to the Jezreel Valley to join the Antichrist army. Now, Babylon will be the religious, political, and economic capital of the world, the Antichrist headquarters. At this point, Antichrist will leave his headquarters and he will join his troops in the Jezreel Valley. This is the second stage of the Campaign of Armageddon. Well, his move leaves Babylon open for destruction, and that's the third stage. This is what we're talking about in Isaiah, the destruction of Babylon in the tribulation period. We learn from Jeremiah 51, 27 and 28, that the kingdoms of Ararat, located approximately there, and Mini, located approximately there, and Ashkenaz, which is off the map to the north, these three kingdoms will join together with a fourth kingdom, with the Medes, and they will come against Babylon from the north in a devastating surprise attack. And Babylon, the city of the Antichrist, the headquarters, the world headquarters of the Antichrist, will be eliminated, exterminated violently and quickly. So that's what we're looking at in chapter 13 of the book of Isaiah. So let's move on then and pick it up with our next verse, verse 18. And their bows will mow down the young men. They will not even have compassion on the fruit of the womb, nor will their eye pity children. So in verse 18, the fact that the population of Babylon is going to be destroyed is repeated. And then the fall of the city of Babylon is repeated in verse 19. And Babylon, the beauty of the kingdoms, the glory of the Chaldeans' pride, will be as when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. So notice the comparison with Sodom and Gomorrah. Absolute, total destruction. In verse 20, we learn that there'll be an absence of human habitation in Babylon. Verse 20, it will never be inhabited or lived in from generation to generation, nor will the Arab pitch his tent there, nor will shepherds make their flocks lie down there. Now, if you look at the history of Babylon, we see that Babylon has never suffered a destruction like this. This section of Scripture remains unfulfilled. When Babylon fell to Cyrus, the Medo-Persian, Babylon was not destroyed. It was taken without a fight, and the only one killed was Belshazzar, the Babylonian king, and he was executed. This is in Daniel 5. Many Jewish people lived in the city of Babylon at that time, and Daniel was one of those people. So Babylon continued to exist until about 500 AD or so. Then it just faded out into a ghost town. There was a large Jewish population there in Babylon in the day of Jesus in the first century. And so Arabs do pitch their tents in the area of Babylon today, and they do graze their flocks in the area of the ancient city of Babylon today. So verse 20 has not been fulfilled. Therefore, the verse demands a rebuilding of Babylon in preparation for its final, absolute, and violent destruction. And guess what? The former dictator of Iraq, Saddam Hussein, has started that process already. This is a photograph taken by a U.S. Marine who was stationed over there during our intercession for Iraq. And he took these pictures of Babylon's buildings and ramparts. So this city will be the core of the Antichrist's headquarters. It will become the world economic, political, and religious center under Antichrist's rule. Now, I said that there were no human inhabitants of Babylon after it is destroyed, but there will be future inhabitants in verses 21 and 22. But desert creatures will lie down there, and their houses will be full of owls. Ostriches will also live there, and shaggy goats will frolic there. Hyenas will howl in their fortified towers, and jackals in their luxurious palaces. So these translations make it appear that the inhabitants of the Babylon area will be solitary desert animals. But that's really not the whole story. These words are very obscure. Most translators don't really know how to handle these words, and there's a lot of variation in the way these words are rendered into English. For example, the animals of Isaiah 13, 21, and 22 on this chart, we'll just pick out a phrase in chapter 13, verse 21, and see how some different versions handle this. In 13:21, we read, houses full of something. Now, how do some major translations handle this? The NASB says owls, houses full of owls. The Tanakh translates it houses full of owls. So these two translation teams felt that these were birds here, certain birds, owls. But let's take a look at the Jewish Publication Society version, houses full of ferrets. Well, these are not birds. This is a mammal. This is a little animal now. And then the NET Bible, the NET Bible, says these are houses full of hyenas. Well, again, they're saying these are animals, but ferrets and hyenas are two different things. The Amplified Bible just goes generic and says these are howling creatures, and the King James Version says these are doleful creatures. So you can see there's really no agreement as to how this particular phrase should be rendered and what these animals actually are. However, There is one word among all those words that translators are pretty sure of, and that's found in verse 21 in the phrase, something will frolic there. Something will frolic there. Now, how do the versions handle this particular animal? The NASB says goats, and with the note, goat demons will frolic there. The Tanakh translates it, satyrs will frolic there. Well, those are demons. JPS translation, satyrs will frolic there. Again, demons. The NET Bible, wild goats. Well, they agree with the idea of wild goats, although they don't go quite as far as saying they are demons. The Amplified Bible says wild goats like demons. And finally, the King James translates it, satyrs. So all these translations are pretty much in the same ballpark. They're pretty much in agreement. And the reason is because this word, wild goats, se'irim, speaks of demons in goat form. Se'irim means demons in goat form. This is referred to in Leviticus 17:7 as well. They shall no longer sacrifice their sacrifices to the se'irim, to the goat demons, with which they play the harlot. This shall be a permanent statute for them throughout their generations. So this is a reference to a form of demon worship. And so we can come to the conclusion then that the city of Babylon, after it is destroyed, will be inhabited by demons. And this is supported by Revelation 18:2 as well. Revelation 18:2. And he cried out with a mighty voice, saying, fallen, fallen is Babylon the Great. She has become a dwelling place of demons and a prison of every unclean spirit and a prison of every unclean and hateful bird. And so the area of the city of Babylon, once it's destroyed, will be a place of confinement, a prison for the demons. They won't be allowed to roam the earth the way they are now during the Messianic Kingdom. They will be confined to that area. And that will happen in verse 22. Her fateful time also will soon come, and her days will not be prolonged. So when the appointed time comes, the event will certainly take place. There'll be no delay in its execution. Babylon will be destroyed and become a haunt for demons. All right, at this point, let's take a few minutes to do a drash, to look at an application of verses chapter 11 through 13. And the theme I chose for this particular drash, this particular application, is the theme of that day. And what day am I talking about? The day of the Messiah's reign, the day when Yeshua returns and reigns. So the biblical material, in the day that Messiah Yeshua takes control of the earth, there will be on one hand a joyous physical and spiritual salvation for some, and on the other hand, great destruction for others. Note that contrast. So let's get personal with this now. When that day arrives, what will be your experience? Will you experience the joys of spiritual salvation, or will you experience the agony of spiritual destruction? That's the question I want each of my students to ask themselves. And I want you to write down where you will find yourself. Write it down. There's only three words you need to write down, or I should say only three answers. One answer would be saved. I'm saved. The other answer would be I'm lost. And then a third answer could be I don't know. I don't know. Where do you fit in? What word, what phrase would characterize where you sit today? Now, if you wrote down saved because you're a believer, write down something you could do to help others turn to Yeshua for salvation. God desires that all men be saved, so we need to all take part in that process. But if you wrote down lost, or if you wrote down I don't know, you can change from your current position instantly by simply acknowledging that you are a sinner and in need of salvation from God. You acknowledge this to God by simply talking to Him personally in prayer. When you put your trust in Yeshua as your personal Messiah and Savior, He instantly, at that moment, saves you from the destruction He has decreed upon all sinners. This decision to personally trust the Messiah is the most practical thing you could do if you do not know what you will experience in the day when Jesus rules. Or if you know that at this moment you would suffer His judgment, if you realize that you would suffer His judgment if He showed up today. The most practical thing you do is place your trust in Him. If this is your desire to trust Yeshua as your Savior, write that down. Write that down. And then acknowledge your desire to trust Yeshua in prayer. Go to God in prayer and tell Him, Lord, I want Jesus to be my Savior. I recognize I'm a sinner. I want to experience the joy of return and not the wrath that your return will bring against the sinners. All right, so please consider that application very seriously. Okay, let's move on then to chapter 14. And we're in the tribulation period at the end of chapter 13. Now we move into the kingdom again in chapter 14, verses 1 through 11. And the first emphasis of Isaiah chapter 14, verses 1 and 2, is the restoration of Israel. The time of Babylon's destruction will also be the time of Israel's final restoration. So we begin with the restoration of the Jewish community in chapter 14, verse 1. Then the Lord will have compassion on Jacob and again choose Israel and settle them in their own land. And He makes three promises in this first part of verse 1. First of all, the first promise is that the Lord will have compassion on Jacob. No longer will Jacob experience wrath. And then the Lord will again choose Israel. Well, this is a reference to a certain period of time in the history of Israel known as the Lo Ami period. This is found in Isaiah chapter 1. And so as Israel has entered into the Lo Ami period when we rejected Jesus as the Messiah. But this Lo Ami period, this not my people period, will come to an end. And that's the point of Isaiah chapter 1 verse 10. Here Hosea writes, "Yet the number of the sons of Israel will be like the sand of the sea, which cannot be measured or numbered. And in the place where it was said to them, 'You are not my people,'" that's a reference to the previously mentioned Lo Ami, not my people period, "where it is said to them, 'You are not my people,' it will be said to them, 'You are the sons of the living God.'" So the Lord will again choose Israel. The Lo Ami period will come to a close. Now this comment to choose Israel doesn't mean that He has rejected Israel. It just means He is going to actualize His promises to Israel. It's the same as the statement, remembering the covenant. God doesn't forget things, but these statements to choose and to remember focus on the fact that he will now actualize the blessings of the covenant. So he will make good on his promises to the Jewish people, and then he will set them in their own land. And this is a reference to the second worldwide regathering. Remember the two worldwide regatherings we looked at? Number one, beginning in 1948, the first regathering is in unbelief in preparation for judgment, which is the tribulation. And the second worldwide regathering will be in faith in preparation for blessing, the blessing of the kingdom. So this is what Isaiah is referring to in chapter 14 as well. If you would like more information about the two worldwide regatherings the Jewish people will experience, I would recommend you pick up the book Footsteps of the Messiah, a study in the sequence of prophetic events by Dr. Arnold G. Fruchtenbaum, available from Ariel Ministries. Pick that up, and that'll give you a good information about the two worldwide regatherings, more detailed than I'm providing for you here. So the first emphasis is the restoration of Israel. The second emphasis of chapter 14, verse 1, is the possession of the Gentiles. The stranger, the Gentile, will join and cleave to the house of Israel. Chapter 14, verse 1, second half of the verse. Then strangers will join and attach themselves to the house of Jacob. So instead of Israel being despised by the Gentiles, the nation will be desired by the Gentiles. And the Gentiles will bring the Jews back to their land in chapter 14, verse 2. The peoples will take them along and bring them to their place. And then in verse 2, we also learn that the Gentiles will be the servants of the Jewish people. And the house of Israel will possess them as an inheritance in the land of the Lord, as male servants and female servants, and they will take their captors captive and rule over their oppressors. So this is going to be a willing, loving master-servant relationship between Jew and Gentile. This is in contrast to the treatment Israel has suffered at the hands of Gentiles right up to the modern day. And note, again, this will happen in the land of Israel. This will not be a worldwide experience. It will be the experience for those Gentiles that want to live in the land of Israel. All right, now God returns to his main emphasis, which is the fall of Babylon. So he begins by talking about the fall of the king of Babylon in verses 3 through 23. And the king of that day will be Antichrist. So we see that the Antichrist staff will be broken, and again in verse 3. And it will be in that day when the Lord gives you rest from your pain and turmoil and harsh service in which you have been enslaved. So the time indicator is in the day of rest. And the reason that the rest will occur is the cessation of the oppressor. The end of the Antichrist rule has to occur in order for Israel to receive her millennial rest. Verse 4. You will take up this taunt against the king of Babylon and say, how the oppressor has ceased, how fury has ceased. So the king and the city will be destroyed. In verse 5. The Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of rulers. So these two symbols of his authority are removed. So he cannot rule any longer. And again, here's that picture of Sargon II with his staff and his scepter. This is his staff, signifying that he is the shepherd over his empire. And this is the scepter, signifying that he has authority and power over his empire. So those two symbols of power and authority will be removed from the Antichrist. Then the devastation that his power and authority has brought on the world is described in verse 6, which used to strike the peoples in fury with unceasing strokes, which subdued the nations in anger with unrestrained persecution. So the first part of the verse says he smote the peoples in wrath continually, and that would be a reference to the Jewish people during the tribulation holocaust. Remember Zechariah 13:8. It will come about in all the world, declares the Lord, that two parts in it will be cut off and perish, but the third will be left in it. So remember, during the tribulation holocaust, two-thirds of the worldwide Jewish population will be killed. That's reference in chapter 14, verse 6, of the Antichrist smiting the peoples with continual blows. But he will also rule the nations in anger. This is a reference to the Gentile nations of the world. In other words, he is going to rule with unrestrained persecution. He is going to be a brutal and cruel ruler. But now the brutal and cruel ruler is gone, and in response to his fall, a song of exultation breaks forth all over the world in verse 7 and 8. The whole earth is set at rest and is quiet. They break forth into shouts of joy. Even the cypress trees rejoice over you, and the cedars of Lebanon, saying, since you were laid low, no tree cutter comes up against us. So again, note that this is worldwide in scope. This is during the kingdom period. So the earth is finally at rest and quiet in verse 7. And then there's that reference to the trees. Well, if that reference is literal, then the trees are being personified by the text. But if the reference is symbolic, that refers to the leaders of the nations. But whatever it refers to, the Antichrist was the final oppressor, and he is finally gone. But he's not gone from our sight. We now get to follow the soul of the Antichrist as he descends into Sheol. The Antichrist will be the first casualty of the second coming, and his soul will enter into the place of the dead. And so Sheol is stirred up in verse 9. Sheol from beneath is excited over you to meet you when you come. It arouses for you the spirits of the dead, all the leaders of the earth. It raises all the kings of the nations from their thrones. So here the dead are referred to as the Raphaim. The Raphaim means the shades. See, men still exist. They still exist, but they are reduced to shadows. They have hardly any more reality than that. They rise up to make a few remarks. They lapse back into inactivity. And I have a friend, a Jewish believer named Wendy, and we were talking about this one day, and she used to be a medium before she became a believer. She was a medium, and she says this is a very accurate description of this world, of the place of the unbeliever in the place of the dead. So as the Antichrist enters into Sheol, suddenly these previous kings spring up in astonishment that this one, the greatest king that's ever been on planet Earth, has become the same as they. And they come to greet him, and they make astonishing comments as they greet him in verse 10. They will all respond and say to you, even you have been made weak as we. You have become like us. You've become a mere shadow like we are. You're no greater than any of us in your fate. So they come out of these shadows to make these comments of surprise, and then sink back into the shadows. Verse 11, your pomp and the music of your harps have been brought down to Sheol, to the place of the dead. Maggots are spread out as your bed beneath you, and worms are your covering. So once the Antichrist walked on luxurious rugs, now he walks on a rug of worms. All right, let's take a moment or two to talk about this area, this concept called Sheol, the place of the dead. Now, Sheol is the Hebrew for the place of the dead, and Hades is the Greek for the place of the dead. So all those who died in Old Testament times went to Sheol. Now, we learn from Luke 16 that Sheol has two divisions. One side is called Paradise, or Abraham's bosom. This is where the saved righteous dead went. This is the place for all the Old Testament saints. Now, the Old Testament sacrifices were sufficient to keep them out of hell, but they were insufficient to get them into heaven. Now, the sins, that's because the sins of the Old Testament saints had to be removed by the Messiah's sacrificial, substitutionary sacrifice on the cross. Then there's another side to Sheol. And this other side appears to have three subdivisions. The first subdivision is hell. This is the abode of all unsaved men's souls, Luke 16. The second subdivision would be called the abyss. This is a temporary place of confinement for some fallen angels, many of whom will be released during the tribulation, Revelation 9, Revelation 20. And the third compartment of hell here appears to be is Tartarus. This is the prison for fallen angels. This is a prison for the angels who sinned in Genesis 6. This is the darkest pit of hell, 2 Peter 2:4. So notice, there are degrees of punishment in hell, in Sheol. Now, in between these two is a great gulf. We learned that from Luke 16. Now, in Luke 16, the people on either side, in either compartment there, could see and communicate with each other, but they couldn't cross from place to place. So this speaks of eternal security. Once you're in paradise, you can't leave paradise. And the same goes for hell as well. You can't cross that great gulf. Now, when Yeshua died, he descended into Sheol, and he announced that the atonement had been accomplished to all in Sheol. And then he ascended into heaven, and he brought paradise with him up to heaven. So he brought paradise to heaven. And today, when a saint dies, his soul goes straight to heaven, straight to God's presence. Well, what about hell, the abyss, and Tartarus? What about them? Well, when the unbeliever dies today, his soul goes into hell. And after the millennial kingdom, this half of Sheol will be cast into the lake of fire. And so the lake of fire will be the eternal abode of the lost. So what we're dealing with here is the Antichrist's arrival in hell. Now in verse 12, we start a new subject. We've just described the demise of the Antichrist into hell itself. Isaiah now turns to another person, a person that controlled the Antichrist, a person that once himself fell from a great and high estate. The fall of Satan, the fall of Satan, is now described before we get into a description of the body of the Antichrist. So Isaiah has dealt with the soul of the Antichrist. He will also have some comments to make about the body of the Antichrist later. So here's a quick outline of where we're going in chapter 14, verses 9 through 20. We've looked in verses 9 through 11 at the soul of the Antichrist in hell. In verses 12 through 15, we examine the fall of Satan. And in verses 16 through 20, we get a glimpse of the body of the Antichrist on earth. And the point here is that what happens to Antichrist is a preview of what will happen to Satan. What happens to Antichrist is a preview of what will happen to Satan. Now, before we get into that, let's remember to look at the features of the Messianic Kingdom we just finished reading about. We saw that Israel, the 22nd feature we've discovered now, Israel will be restored in fulfillment of the Abrahamic covenant in verses 1 and 2. The 23rd feature, the Antichrist will be judged. And so we move from the kingdom now to the distant past in verses 12 through 15 as we deal with the fall of Satan. We deal with the fall of Satan. The fall itself is described in verse 12. How you have fallen from heaven, O star of the morning, son of the dawn. You've been cut down to the earth, you who have weakened the nations. Now his name here is Daystar, or star of the morning. Hebrew is Halel, meaning basically bright one. This is a reference to the morning star. That would be the preferred translation, the literal translation. It's referring to the last and brightest star in the morning sky. Now, in Latin, that term is the term Lucifer. That's where we get the term Lucifer. So you see, the King James Version just chose to bring the Latin into that English translation. It's the Latin for day star. So that's where Lucifer comes from. Now, a star is always a symbol of an angel, and of course that's what it is a symbol of here too. Satan is an angelic being. He's also called Son of the Dawn, Son of the Dawn. So his full name is Morning Star, Son of the Dawn, or he's called that here. And that indicates to us that when Satan was created, he possessed great glory. Now this term, Morning Star, has other uses as well. It's not limited to Satan, but it also describes Yeshua. It also describes Yeshua. Revelation 22:16. I, Yeshua, have sent my angel to testify to you these things for the churches. I am the root and descendant of David, the what? The bright and morning star. This term also describes the second coming of Yeshua, 2 Peter 1:19. So we have the prophetic word made more sure, to which you do well to pay attention as a lamp shining in a dark place, until the day dawns and the morning star, there it is, the morning star arises in your hearts. So it refers to Yeshua at the second coming as well. And finally, it also describes fellowship with Yeshua. In Revelation, I will give him the morning star, fellowship with Yeshua. So when Satan takes this title for himself, Satan is impersonating Yeshua. And so we've seen that he will fall from heaven to the ground. That is supported by Revelation 12, verses 7 through 9 as well. There was war in heaven. Michael and his angels waging war with the dragon. The dragon and his angels waged war, and they were not strong enough. There was no longer a place found for them in heaven. And the great dragon was thrown down. The serpent of old, who is called the devil and Satan, who deceives the whole world, he was thrown down to the earth, and his angels were thrown down with him. So that's the fall from heaven that Isaiah is describing. Now, in verse 15, in a few verses further on, we'll see that this fall will continue down to Sheol, to the abyss. Now, why did Satan fall? Why was he cast out of heaven? Well, the reason is his five I will statements in verses 13 and 14. Satan's five I wills, chapter 14, verses 13 and 14. Verse 13, but you said in your heart, we'll look at the statement and its significance. You said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven. In other words, Satan wanted a position, a higher position than he already had. He was already the guardian cherub, the guardian angel assigned over God's throne. But he wanted more than that. I will ascend to heaven, a higher position. Secondly, I will raise my throne above the stars of God. He wanted the angel, the archangel Michael's job. He wanted rulership over the angels as well. Thirdly, and I will sit on the mount of the assembly in the recesses of the north. Well, Satan knew the messianic program, and here this statement indicates he wanted to be the Messiah. He wanted to rule over Israel as the Messiah. The mount of the assembly would refer to the chosen people there. Next, I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. In other words, he wanted God's glory. God's glory is always symbolized by the glory cloud. And finally, I will make myself like the Most High. He wanted to be God. He wanted the whole Megillah, didn't he? He wanted the possessor of heaven and earth. He wanted every scrap of authority and power that God has graciously given out to different angels and to his chosen people, that kind of thing. He wanted it all. And so because of that pride, he fell. And you know, there will be similar claims made by the Antichrist. For example, in Daniel 7:25, speaking of Antichrist, he will speak out against the Most High and wear down the saints of the Highest One. And he will intend to make alterations in times and in law. And they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. So Antichrist will speak out against the Most High, just the way Satan did. Daniel 11:35, then the king will do as he pleases, that's Antichrist, and he will exalt and magnify himself above every god, and will speak monstrous things against the God of gods, and he will prosper until the indignation is finished, for that which is decreed will be done. So here it is, he will magnify himself and speak monstrous things against God. Again, following the course of his mentor. And in Revelation 13:6, and he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is those who dwell in heaven. So the Antichrist will copy his mentor, Satan, in blaspheming God. In verse 15, we see Satan's fall into Sheol. Nevertheless, you will be thrust down to Sheol, to the recesses of the pit. And the recesses of the pit is the abyss. This will happen at the end of the tribulation in Revelation 20. Then I saw an angel coming down from heaven, holding the key of the abyss and a great chain in his hand. And he laid hold of the dragon, the serpent of old, who is the devil and Satan, and bound him for 1,000 years. And he threw him into the abyss and shut it and sealed it over him so that he would not deceive the nations any longer until the 1,000 years were completed. After these things, he must be released for a short time. And so that ends our glance at the fate of Satan. But now our attention returns to the body of the Antichrist on earth. Remember, we looked at the soul of the Antichrist in hell. We've just looked at the fall of Satan. And now our gaze returns to the body of the Antichrist on earth. And again, we move from the distant past. We're now at the end of the tribulation period. So we begin by noting the astonishment of those who view the dead body of the Antichrist on earth, here in verses 16 and 17. Those who see you will gaze at you. They will ponder over you, saying, "Is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world like a wilderness and overthrew its cities, who did not allow his prisoners to go home?" So on earth there are surprised questions by people looking at his fate. They can't believe that this man shook kingdoms at one time, that this man made the world into a wilderness at one time, that this man overthrew great cities, that this man was powerful enough never to release prisoners. They're just astounded as they see his corpse. And then in verses 18 through 20, the exposure of the Antichrist's body is described. It's compared, first of all, to the tombs of lesser kings in verse 18. All the kings of the nations lie in glory, each in his own tomb. So many of the other kings of the earth sleep or die or buried in great splendor and glory. They sleep in their own sepulchres. And for example, we have the tomb of Cyrus. This is the sepulcher of Cyrus, who was the king of Persia, Medo-Persia, at one time. And he has a glorious tomb. And then here's the tomb of Xerxes, cut out of the side of a mountain. And even our patriarchs, the tomb of Abraham and the patriarchs here in Hebron, marked by this beautiful, huge building. So all these lesser kings sleep in glory. But this is not going to be true of the Antichrist. His body is going to be exposed in verse 19. "But you have been cast out of your tomb like a rejected branch, clothed with the slain who are pierced with a sword, who go down to the stones of the pit like a trampled corpse." So his body's not going to go into any magnificent sepulcher. Instead, it's going to be covered with the dead bodies of his soldiers, and his body is going to be trodden underfoot by his soldiers. Now, the reasons for this exposure, in verse 20, "You will not be united with them in burial," that's the previous kings, "you will not be united with them in burial because you have ruined your country, you have slain your people. May the offspring of evildoers not be mentioned forever." So here are the reasons for the exposure. First of all, he's a destroyer. He's destroyed the land. Second of all, he's a murderer. He's killed his own people. And thirdly, He's exposed because God will not allow evil ones to be in control forever. Their time is limited. Now we get further information about the fate of the Antichrist from other portions of Scripture. We learn that the Antichrist will be killed at the second coming of the Messiah. This is 2 Thessalonians 2:8. "Then that lawless one will be revealed, whom the Lord will slay with the breath of his mouth and bring to an end by the appearance of his coming." And so there's the soul of the Antichrist heading into hell. But the Antichrist will be resurrected, and then his soul and body cast into the lake of fire, Revelation 19. "And the beast," speaking of Antichrist there, "was seized, and with him the false prophet, who performed the signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who had received the mark of the beast, and those who worshipped his image. These two were thrown alive into the lake of fire, which burns with brimstone." And so this will occur before the millennium gets going. The Antichrist and the false prophet will be cast into the lake of fire together, and they'll have the swimming hole all to themselves for the next 1,000 years. Some further results are described in verses 21 through 23. Further results of the destruction of the city of Babylon and the Antichrist. First of all, in verse 21, we see the destruction of the king's family. Let me back that up. Prepare for his sons a place of slaughter because of the iniquity of their fathers. They must not arise and take possession of the earth and fill the earth and fill the face of the world with cities. So apparently the Antichrist is going to have children, sons, but they are not going to be allowed to live lest they colonize the earth, lest they export his evil throughout the earth once again. And then it's repeated that the population of Babylon will be destroyed, verse 22. I will rise up against them, declares the Lord of hosts, and I will cut off from Babylon name and survivors, offspring and posterity, declares the Lord. So this is the third time it's been repeated that the destruction of Babylon's population. Excuse me. Now, when God says something once, it's important. When he says it twice, it's super important. If he repeats it three times, you better pay attention. It's going to happen. The population of Babylon will be totally destroyed without exception. Without exception. Everyone. And then the destruction of the city itself is repeated in verse 23. Again, this is the third repetition. I will also make it a possession for the hedgehog and swamps of water, and I will sweep it with the broom of destruction, declares the Lord of hosts. So remember, it's going to be possessed by demons, a prison for the demons, and it will be treated like rubbish, something to be swept away. Now, while the whole earth has been beautified during the millennial kingdom, we learn that there will be two spots of burning and destruction in Isaiah 14:23 and Isaiah 34:8 through 15. So we'll look at the second spot when we get to Isaiah 34. That second spot in Isaiah 34 is Edom, and the first area here in Isaiah 14 is Babylon. The rest of the world will be thriving, but these two areas will be areas of destruction and a prison for demons. We'll get to that in a little bit. All right, now we've come to chapter 14, verses 24 through 27, and now we return to the near future, Isaiah's day in the near future to Isaiah, and we look at the destruction of Assyria. And of course, Assyria located up in this area of the Middle East. We begin with the Lord's oath that he will destroy Assyria in verse 24. The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, surely, just as I have intended, so it has happened. And just as I have planned, so it will stand. So here the Lord swears by himself. This points to the dependability of God's pronouncement. He can't swear by anything higher than himself. That assures that the oath will be kept. And that oath statement is, I have thought, it shall come to pass. I have purposed, it shall stand. So these statements guarantee that this oath will come to pass. The fulfillment of the oath is described in verse 25. I will break Assyria in my land, and I will trample him on my mountains. Then his yoke will be removed from them, and his burden removed from their shoulder. So notice, I will break the Assyrian in my land. It's not going to happen in Assyria. It's going to happen in the land of Israel. So the instrument in God's hand, the Assyrians, was now going to be broken by the one who wields the instrument. Remember, nations and governments are tools in God's hands. And again, notice it will happen in my land. Notice who owns the land. It's owned by God. God is the owner of the territory, and he can give it to whoever he wishes. And of course, he has given it through the Abrahamic covenant and the land covenant to the Jewish people. So we'll see this breaking of the Assyrian to be fulfilled in Isaiah 36 and 37. The particular Assyrian king who's going to experience this is Sennacherib. So the yoke of the Assyrians will be broken and their burden lifted off the Jewish people. And now God states why he's doing it, his purpose for all of this in verse 26. This is the plan devised against the whole earth, and this is the hand that is stretched out against all the nations. So God has a purpose for the whole earth, beginning with Assyria. It's a worldwide purpose, a worldwide plan. It's not limited to Assyria, but it commences with Assyria. So his hand is stretched out in judgment against all of the nations. He's ready to strike down all of the nations. And the nations that will be struck first from Isaiah's day on will be Assyria. Assyria. The destruction of Assyria begins a process that will reach its conclusion in the Great Tribulation. So this process is going on right now. So what begins locally with Assyria will culminate in a worldwide manner on Babylon. And it will be impossible to alleviate or stop this plan. Verse 27. For the Lord of hosts has planned, who can frustrate it? And as for his stretched out hand, who can turn it back? So these are rhetorical questions, and the answer to each one is no one. Can anyone annul God's purposes? No. Can anyone stop God's hand of judgment? No way. This is going to happen. Now, as we continue on in the oracles against the nations, we now enter into a difficult section of Scripture. Commentators are extremely divided over the interpretation of chapter 14 through chapter 18. It's sometimes hard to tell exactly what Isaiah means. It's hard to tell what he means in a good number of places. And so translations vary from version to version. And so your translation might be rendered a little different than the one I read, which would be the NASB. So I hope this isn't unsettling to anyone, but I mention this because we have to enter into this section of Scripture with our eyes wide open. There is room for some variety here. All right, so let's move on into this difficult section, and I will give it my best shot for all of you. We begin with the destruction of Philistia. And here's a map. Philistia, of course, is on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea there, up against Israel. So the burden of Philistia is in verse 28. In the year that King Ahaz died, this oracle came. So we're given a specific date. That date happens to be 727 BC. This is when Ahaz's son Hezekiah becomes sole king. He shared the throne with Ahaz and for a number of years, and now he is the sole occupant of the throne of the southern kingdom. Now, what's the significance of this date? Well, basically, pro-Assyrian Ahaz is dead. Pro-Assyrian Ahaz is gone. He wanted to ally with Assyria. And now anti-Assyrian Hezekiah is on the throne. Anti-Assyrian Hezekiah reigns. So Philistia knows all about this. So Philistia sent a message to Hezekiah. We'll learn this in verse 32. Philistia sent a message to Hezekiah proposing a revolt. Now Isaiah warns Hezekiah that Philistia is doomed. Don't become their ally. That's the basic idea here. So the coming judgment is mentioned in verse 29. We are, of course, in the near future, close to Isaiah's time. All right, verse 29. Do not rejoice, O Philistia, all of you, because the rod that struck you is broken. For from the serpent's root a viper will come out, and its fruit will be a flying serpent. Now in verse 29 he says, all of you. That's because Philistia is composed of five city-states with five kings. Here are the five Philistine cities: Ashkelon, Ashdod, Gaza, Ekron, and Gath. Those are the five Philistine cities. So all five cities are going to be affected. And the progression goes from bad to worse. It's described first as a serpent, which is a mild attack. Then it's described as a viper, which is poisonous, and then finally as a flying, fiery serpent, which is deadly. So the judgment will go from bad to worse, from serpent to viper to flying, fiery serpent, from mild to poisonous to deadly. Now, apparently God has in mind three kings here because of the subsequent history of Philistia. Who those three kings are, we don't know. Some think they're Jewish kings. Others think they are Assyrian kings. So we don't know what the verse refers to particularly or solidly, But we do know the results. We do know the results. The results is a contrast between two parties, beginning in verse 30. Those who are most helpless will eat, and the needy will lie down in security. So for Israel, there'll be food and safety. But for Philistia, in verse 30, there will be hunger and death. I will destroy your root with famine, and it will kill off your survivors. So Philistia, hunger and death. And my timer has just gone off. I've got 5 minutes left. So let's try to bring this to a close here. In verse 31, we come to a description of the destruction of Philistia. Wail, O gate, cry, O city, melt away, O Philistia, all of you, for smoke comes from the north, and there is no straggler in its ranks. And so all of you, all five of these cities are going to be destroyed. They're all going to melt away. And they're going to melt away and be destroyed by this invasion from the north. And the invasion from the north includes the Assyrians and the Babylonians. The fact that there's no stragglers mentioned speaks of the discipline of these two armies, the discipline of these armies. But in contrast, Zion will be chosen. The message to Hezekiah is, don't join with Philistia. They are doomed. Zion is not. So the question of Philistia in verse 32, how then will one answer the messengers of the nation? The nation is Philistia. Philistia sent envoys to Hezekiah proposing a military alliance. The answer to Philistia in verse 32, that the Lord has founded Zion, and the afflicted of his people will seek refuge in it. Okay? The Lord has founded Zion, and in Zion, the Jewish people will find refuge. In other words, the message is here, don't take refuge in a military alliance with Philistia. Don't do it. Don't do it. All right, we now come to chapter 15 and the devastation of Moab, but we're just about out of time, so it probably would be good to start our next session here at chapter 15, verse 1. All right, so we will pick it up next session, chapter 15, verse 1, with the destruction of Moab, and we'll work our way through that. So thanks for being our students. We'll see you next session. Lehitraot. Lehitraot.